good afternoon. You're very welcome to Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, school's out for TDs, but the war continues as the battle for the Shannon looks set to rumble on over the long, hot summer. Where do the parties stand now at the end of an eventful political year? We'll discuss the winners and the losers and look ahead to next term with our panel. But before we do all that, let's go to the newsroom now and Michael Murphy.
Good afternoon. The National Association of GPs has claimed that the health service is on its knees, not because of a lack of funding, but because the funds are being badly spent. An extraordinary general meeting of the newly revived organisation is being held in Portlaoise. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
Around 60 doctors are attending this extraordinary general meeting of the relaunched National Association of GPs, which aims to become a new representative body for family doctors. Its chief executive, Chris Goody, claimed the walls were caving in on GPs, and with financial pressures, around 8% of practices would close. He told the meeting that the health service was on its knees, not because of a lack of money, but because of how it is spent. He said more money needs to be reallocated to primary care, which sees 92% of all clinical cases. Oliver O'Connor, a former advisor to Mary Harney as health minister, predicted that free GP care would cost €600 million and that universal health insurance would not happen until 2021, as it is so complex. He said family doctors should not be looking for more GPs or more money for GPs, but should focus on more cost and clinically effective care. Fergal Bowers, RTE News, Portlaoise.
Five men have been found guilty of manslaughter for the capsizing of the Costa Concordia off the coast of Italy last year, which led to the deaths of 32 people. The boat's helmsman, the onboard hotel director, two naval officers and the head of the Italian cruise company's crisis unit were convicted by an Italian court this morning. The trial of the captain, Francesco Schettino, has been adjourned after he requested electrical tests on the ship. The Taoiseach and Minister for Foreign Affairs has urged political and community leaders in Belfast to prevent a recurrence of violence this weekend. Eamon Gilmore made the comments as police launched a major security operation in North Belfast ahead of a controversial Orange Order parade this afternoon. The order says it intends to have a peaceful protest at the police lines and then to disperse. Here's Brendan Wright of our Northern staff.
The parade, made up of three Orange Lodges, several bands and supporters, begins in the Loyalist Shankill Road area and will proceed towards North Belfast. As on the 12th of July, the marchers will be prevented by a large force of PSNI riot police from taking their preferred route past the Nationalist Ardoyne area, from which they've been banned by the Parades Commission. The march is expected to stop at a line of Orange Order marshals in front of the police cordon. The order says that after a period, it's not clear how long that will be, the British National Anthem will be played and then all present will disperse. The Orangemen say they want this to be an entirely peaceful event and they say anyone intent on causing trouble should stay away. Brendan Wright, RTE News, Belfast.
The time is 3.5 minutes past one and the weather forecast. It'll be hot today with long spells of sunshine. It'll be generally dry, but later today some heavy showers or thunderstorms will develop in parts of Connacht and Donegal. There'll be highs of 23 to 29 degrees in general, but it could reach 30 degrees in parts of the Midlands and the West. That's the news for the moment. Back now to Clare.
Michael, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. We welcome your views on any of the topics on the programme. You can text us 51551. The email address, saturday@rte.ie. The Twitter address is @SaturdayRTE. And joining us today in the studio, we have Roisin Shortall, Independent TD and former Junior Minister for Health, Independent Senator Gillian Van Turnhout, Dermot MacDonald, Legal Editor with the Irish Independent, Brian Dowling from RTE's political staff, and Mary Minahan from the Irish Times. You're all very welcome. And we hear 30 degrees in the weather forecast and you're all still here, so it's great to see you. Now, it's perhaps an irony that the formal political year end will happen in the Shannon next week, which is an institution, as we all know, destined for the gallows if the government has its way, because in the coming months we'll all be asked to vote in a referendum on the future of the Shannon. But as the debate began, the House was debating the abortion legislation and became the scene of fairly ugly sparring and offensive language. So did some senators do the abolitionists a favour this week? Here's a reminder of that David Norris clip in full assault mode.
I have just seen this malignant and mendacious
Senator,
piece of crime.
Senator,
no, I want to make
Senator,
one more
order.
I think the Shannon Aaron should immediately put out a press statement
Senator,
here and
Senator,
on a unanimous basis,
Senator,
because this is the tissue of lies, and the idea that somebody like our
Senator,
Gillian, you've lodged a formal complaint about that. Is that right?
No, I an informal complaint directly after that order of business. I did, as appropriate, I felt, I raised the issue with the Cathaoirleach of the Shannon, that I felt that the language I know we've got caught up on the word that was used, but for me, actually, it was the fact that he used her gender in order to denigrate her point. And that for me was the issue that I had. Senator Norris withdrew it the following day. While I would have loved to see an apology, you can't force anybody to apologise. So for me, I have,
issue's closed.
As far as I'm concerned, the issue is closed. I'm not pursuing it any further.
Mm-hmm. Didn't do the Shannon any favours, though, did it?
No, it wasn't a good week for the Shannon. We had three issues, I believe. We had the abolition of the Shannon Bill, we had the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill, and we had the heat wave. And I think it created this electric storm. That for me masked actually some really good contributions in the Shannon this week. But because of this sort of electricity in the room, we also saw the very worst of the Shannon that I've seen in the last 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm. So David Norris might have scored a spectacular own goal, really.
Yeah, I think there was, several senators, I think, for me, acted out of character. I think it was not appropriate, their behaviour, and I would disassociate myself from it. But as I said, I think it's highly regrettable because there was some really outstanding contributions also by other senators, which often gets lost then in the mix.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that I thought was really pertinent in that statement and was neglected a little bit was using the words, someone who's only been in the Dáil a wet week. I thought that was actually more condescending and offensive
and
in a
way.
And
for me, it was the whole gender piece. I felt it was more that you don't have a right. I'm only, also, if you want to use the same terminology there, wet week, I don't think my voice is any less or any more than any other senator.
Have you experienced any condescension yourself because of your newness?
And not because of my newness, no.
other reason?
I think maybe because of the way, you vote. And, people will be critical of the way you vote. And I think perhaps on the Shannon Abolition Bill, I probably came under the biggest pressure this week. I thought it was going to be the Protection of Life Bill. And it's funny how sometimes you're prepared for one thing to be the most emotional moment. And in fact, it was on the Shannon Abolition Bill where I took a choice to ensure that this referendum will go to the people. I don't believe in delaying. I suppose it's this role. I'm a legislator and I'm a citizen. I have my own opinions about the Shannon and I will make those clear in a referendum as a citizen. But as a legislator, I do not believe it is my role to delay any bill by 90 days. If there was a bill I was going to delay, it was on respite care and the cuts in the budget. And we were within a hair's whisper of delaying that by 90 days and we didn't. That was the moment we should have delayed. So for me on that vote, actually I came under huge pressure from the opposition. In fact, I had no conversations with government. I believe I've been promised everything. Unfortunately, I'm still waiting for the new car or whatever I'm being promised because, there was all sort of accusations being made about my vote. I think it was very clear, if anybody listened to my second stage speech, that I said I would not impede the passage of this bill. That is not my role as a legislator.
Mm-hmm. Michael Clifford in The Examiner today, Roisin argues that this whole Shannon referendum is a circus. And he says that Enda has lumped Richard Bruton with a thankless task. What do you make of it?
Well, certainly the timing of it is very peculiar. And I mean, given all of the huge issues facing the country, this is not the most pressing one by any means. And you just wonder why it is that Enda Kenny is kind of pinning his hopes to this, because, I don't think people feel especially strong about it. Certainly, there is a lot of work to be done in terms of reforming the Oireachtas. And just for the record, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the Shannon, I have to say, and I think we could do perfectly well without it. But having said that, what is desperately needed is reform of the Dáil and the way we do business.
So
and,
this is cart before horse in your view?
Yeah, and I mean, the kind of scenes that Gillian was talking about there in the Shannon during the week certainly hasn't done politics any good. But, when you think about it, the the carry-on over the last number of months in the Dáil and Shannon has done a huge amount of damage to politics. It is an antediluvian house, in my view, the Dáil, this is. And, you know, that's not to say that, that the Shannon is any better. But there is an urgent need to reform the way in which the Dáil operates, to make it much more accountable. There is a real danger now at the moment with a huge government majority that, you know, there's certainly a big element of arrogance that has crept into the way the government does its business. There is a complete disregard for the opposition, and they're ramming through legislation. And in spite of promises to reform the Dáil, there's really been no progress at all made in that regard.
So why, in your view, then, are we talking about this referendum happening in the autumn? Why is it happening in the autumn?
I think in many ways it's a big distraction
from the budget.
It's going to take attention away from a lot of other problems in the country. And, you know, if you bear in mind the Dáil has now gone into recess, it'll be coming back in the middle of September. We'll be in the throes of a referendum campaign then for the Shannon, and that's going to run until the end of the first week in October. And within a matter of days of that, we will have another austerity budget.
So we'll all forget about the budget. We'll be talking about the
Shannon. I think that's
Shannon
part
referendum.
Of the strategy that's involved in this.
Anyone else agree, Serval?
It's kind of sinister when you think of it like that. I thought that both houses in the last few weeks made a great case for their abolition. Arguably, what happened in the Dáil was more serious. Like, I mean, the manner in which the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill was put through the Dáil, you know, kind of replaying in a sick way the night the IBRC was liquidated. TDs meandering to and from the Dáil, others who were speaking to an empty chamber. What an insult. Like, as a woman, poor Brian is blessed amongst women this morning, but as a woman, I just found it so, so insulting. Unlike Roisin, I actually will be voting against the abolition of the Shannon. I think this is a two-finger salute to the electorate. Look at the birdies, look at the birdies as we distract you from the budget. What we really need is proper political reform. And I don't know whether abolishing the Shannon is the way to go. I actually think we do need a strong upper chamber. I think we have had some superb contributions. As you say, they were masked this week. And I think the public should see through what is actually being placed to them at this time. Ask them what is the real, you know, we want real, meaningful political reform. And look, when the Fine Gael Labour Coalition came in, they promised to undo everything that Fianna Fáil had done, that they were going to have, you know, proper accountability, strong committees. You know, look, the TDs are just being led in like sheep.
Are we oversimplifying this, though? Is this a pretty drastic distraction tactic to risk abolishing the upper house just so that people won't pay attention to the
reason
budget?
Why I have concerns with the abolition of the Shannon is because of a number of other moves, which I actually think shows a huge political power grab. Like, I mean, if you do, not just the Shannon, the proposed abolition of the Shannon on its own, but if you look at the Oireachtas Inquiry's referendum, there's been a series of things which is all about making power. Like, when you look at it at the moment, we have such an executive excess at the centre of government, which our own Dáil, like, if a politician should be shouting about anything, it's about making their own house. They're more accountable. So, look, one of the biggest problems
with
the crash...
Do you include the Economic Management Council?
I do include the Economic Management Council. And when you look at the part of the reasons why we are in the mess that we are, there's some fantastic contributions in the Irish Times, the Irish Independent today, Ivor Brown, various different writers analysing the crash. And it seems to me that one of the reasons why we got into the situation we did was because there was so much power concentrated in the hands of the few. And that's what politicians should be challenging. And that's why I feel that the proposed abolition of the Shannon is just such a, it's like a reckless distraction. And as a voter and as a citizen, I find that really insulting.
OK, Brian, what do you think? A reckless distraction?
I'm not too sure, because I think, ironically enough, I'm not too sure. I think this will be an austerity budget, but maybe with a small a rather than a capital A. Mm-hmm. I think there's enough straws in the wind at the minute to suggest that, to the extent that they can, the government is going to try and ease off.
To the extent they can, but they were told this week by the Troika, don't ease off the 3.1 billion.
Yes, but I think they're going to find some room. I think they will ease off a little bit. I'm not too sure how much. I mean, it's 3.1 billion. I wouldn't be shocked if it's nearer to 2. Now, will that mean we'll all feel better off? No, we won't feel better off. But it won't feel like recent budgets where there's just another layer of austerity comes into almost everyone's home, whether that's by way of additional charges, whether it's by way of your income being squeezed. It may be that incomes are somewhat neutral after this. And apart from the property tax, everything else may stay as is mm-hmm. in the main.
And it's perception. If someone says, you know, an item is 20 euros and then they eventually give it to you for 15, well, you feel like you're getting a deal, even though it's worth 15.
And the other point is that even if the timing of the Shannon referendum runs right up to the wire in terms of the budget, at the end of the day, I suspect that for the vast majority of people, once budget day comes, they will focus entirely on that and what it means for their own individual situation, for their family, for their friends, and it will take over. There's no doubt about that. But if the referendum is won, fine. If it's lost, I think Enda Kenny will turn around and say, I promise people they could have a referendum. Here's your referendum.
But isn't this one of the problems? We'll find ourselves right up to budget day and then the big announcement made on the 15th of October without any prior discussion about that. Mm. And this government did promise a new budgetary process. They said that, you know, all of the figures would be laid out. There would be full discussion at, you know, different levels within the Dáil. We've seen none of that whatsoever. And now, you know, the situation is going to become even worse this year in terms of lack of any kind of pre-discussion in the run-up to the budget. And you know, the point that Dervla made there about the Economic Management Council does mean that power now is increasingly concentrated in the hands of four people in this country. And that's a very dangerous situation. There's a lot of unease about that, I think, across government generally, but it's no way to do business. We were promised open government and a democratic revolution, and we haven't seen any of that.
The four members of the Economic Management Council undoubtedly have huge influence over the whole budgetary strategy. There's no question about that. Having said that, I think it has to be said as well, Roisin, that you would have to say everybody else who sits at that cabinet table surely has some individual responsibility to stand up for their own respective areas as well, and also to make the case if they feel that they're being excluded.
It's very difficult, though, isn't it?
Out. I mean, like it is
but,
a cabinet.
But Brian, if we have a meeting here, all of us, and we come up with some broad suggestions, and then there are two of you, say it's yourself and Dervla, who are actually making the decision, and you go off into conclave, and you implement your decisions because you have the power to do it. It's very difficult for the rest of us.
What was the situation prior to the EMC, for instance? And I think the situation prior to the EMC was that, in the main, the finance minister of the day sat down, negotiated with every single government department, agreed estimates with them, and played hardball to get the best estimates deal he or she could get.
So you're saying it's better now?
And essentially set the parameters.
But the reality is, in other, let's say, member states, if we look at the budgetary process, if we really wanted to talk about reform, it happens at committee level. It's debated in the months leading up to a budget. The budget isn't some big sort of reveal moment, here you go. Actually, it's actually teased out with opposition, with government.
Which is what Brandon Hyland promised.
And that, for me, is what reform is about. So this idea that abolishing the Shannon is about reform. The reason I am undecided, in theory, I can actually understand why Ireland can do with a unicameral system. The reality is, though, the Dáil is so needs so much reform. The committees, anybody who goes to committees at the moment, there is a small cohort of us on each committee who keep that committee going.
Mary, we aren't allowed on committees at all, which is absolutely independent.
Mary Minahan.
Can I say the potential for this whole Shannon referendum backfiring on Enda Kenny is huge. I think it's going to expose cracks in the coalition that have been masked before, because I think there's a slow dawning realisation in Fine Gael now that they're on their own with this campaign. That Labour are really not that bothered about it. It was kind of just something that occurred to Enda Kenny that he would announce at a dinner one night. So, you know, Labour have their own difficulties in the Shannon. There's no doubt about that. For some Labour people, Labour is just a flag of convenience, I think, within that upper house. You know, we had the intemperate remarks of Norris coming after Lapgate and the Dáil the previous week. You know, I think nobody's going to force the public to be interested in this referendum campaign. You know, there's an enormous sense of disillusionment and just wanting to switch off. Like, the houses of the Oireachtas have looked like, you know, the Big Brother house recently, where just after a while they forget they're on TV and they're just living in a complete bubble. And, you know, intemperate, I suppose, doesn't even come close to describing like the contributions of people like Jim Walsh and Breon O'Donnell during the abortion debate during the week. And I think it was, you know, hugely important that figures from outside politics like the Obs and Gyney Institute came out yesterday to criticise those kind of speeches and say the procedures that they described with what I can only describe as relish wouldn't happen here. And also that we heard voices from the Labour, a little known, I suppose, Labour Senator Marie Maloney, who brought her... It was kind of unfortunate in a way that she maybe felt forced into giving her own private, personal experience of a, a pregnancy that didn't continue and what happened to her. And she wasn't just, you know, speaking for herself. She was pointing to the fact that there were young children in the gallery watching all this. And then you have Fianna Fáil as a whole other story. I was going to say this is the unwritten story of the abortion campaign, but I see that Stephen Collins is writing about it in the Irish Times today in quite a lot of detail, where, you know, the leader of the main opposition party has to come out and kind of disown some of his own senators and say their contributions were a source of regret. So, you know.
And then you wonder why people, you know, have a indifference, maybe an upper range, maybe a contempt or an absolute disdain for a political debate, because, you know, I was writing just last week that, you know, our national parliament is in one of the biggest windows onto the world. And, you know, just to look at it, just to step back and look at what had happened. And up until, you know, until the last 2 weeks, the debate had, I would actually have to give Fine Gael credit for bringing this legislation forward. And then just look what had happened. Like, and how far have we come? Like, we've now, we're going to be passing legislation that deals for a situation back in 1992. And it seems to me that it is so out of step with the public. And there must be, like, for anyone just to be looking at it from the outside in, I was mad and sad. Actually, that was kind of my reaction
at the contributions or at the overnight sitting or at
the overnight sitting. I find very, very offensive, I have to say. You know, and I sat up all night kind of watching it. You know, we weren't nationalising the banks, you know. And after, you know, look, what I thought, what message does it send out to women and to their families and their partners who support them? Because I know they wanted to get the legislation through, but this is an issue that has convulsed our society for 30 years. I can't think of any other issue that has been debated and thought out. And then they just kind of rammed it through in an all-night sitting. And you kind of think, well, why didn't they do that with the personal insolvency legislation? Why didn't they do that with any of the banking stuff? And I just kind of thought, God, are we really beneath contempt that much that they can just throw an all-nighter?
I think it displays a serious disregard for the what's supposed to be the democratic process. You know, I mean, leaving aside the issue itself and what the legislation was about, it was just that contemptuous way of treating members of the Dáil, where the two government parties had hammered out this legislation and they weren't going to change a scintilla in it. And they went through this charade of having umpteen hours of debate and thought that the opposition would talk themselves out. So they said they allowed a certain amount of time up to 12 o'clock. There was no order put on that debate at all. It was the chairing of it was very poor. Mm-hmm. So nobody knew when it was going to end. And then they said, OK, we let it run till 5 o'clock. Okay, I mean, that was just ridiculous. It made a farce of the whole thing.
But government would say, Roisin, that we had the Health Committee hearings in January and then we had further session and we did have a very, very lengthy Health Committee.
But then why trivialise it? Why trivialise it at the end? Here was, I actually agree, it was a very, I attended those Health Committees. It was a very good process. The one thing that came in those debates, and Jerry Buttermer deserves huge credit, compassion came into that debate, understanding, there was respect in that debate. And then just at the very end, you know, you're following, it's going to sit to 2 a.m, 4 a.m, 5 a.m. And people, you know, TDs and everybody knowing the outcome, speaking into an empty chamber while others just kind of went to and from the Dáil bar. And I spoke, because obviously we've been writing so much about this issue, but I spoke to women who have lost their babies to fetal abnormalities. And the amount of people who rang me that night and over the next course of days going, what happened?
But that's the real story.
What happened?
The minimum of 4,000 who go every year. And I say minimum because for obvious reasons, a lot of women from Ireland don't give their addresses when they go over to the UK. And to me, that was the big story. And it just should have been an absolute wake-up call to the TDs and senators. But it didn't filter through at all, you know. And when you break down those figures that you get from the UK Department of Health, you know, when you break them down by age, we're not talking exclusively about young girls here. No. We're talking about mature women in their 30s and 40s. And, you know, there's the whole issue of the silence that surrounds that. And probably correctly so, because pregnancy is a private matter. You know, as poor Marie Maloney had to vocalise, very, very upset she was too. She had to vocalise her own experience. But, you know, I think that should have been a wake-up call, but it just seemed to
those numbers were released on the 5 a.m. day. I remember they sort of got lost in all
but
that.
The difficulty for me in all of that is, you know, and having been a member of the Health and Children Committee and having gone through the 6 days of hearings, one is the interpretation of what has happened at the hearings, because for me, certain senators, certainly in the debate, use it as if there was a blanket agreement on certain statements. There was contrary opinion, expert opinion at those hearings. There was no blanket agreement on anything. So for for me, the interpretation by others of those hearings is disrespectful of our professional medical profession and the experts who came, legal professionals who came before the hearings. And secondly, is many of these issues were brought out, certainly I know, in the Shannon debate. But the difficulty is with senators like Breen O'Donnell and Jim Walsh, they managed to bring us back to an Ireland that I thought we had left behind. And there was relish in the way I was in the chamber when Senator Breen O'Donnell was speaking.
When the air froze.
It really froze. And for me is, you know, Senator Marie Maloney is a good friend of mine as well as being a senator. She had not planned to say what she said. She had not. There was no lead up to it. And I know even she had to ring her husband directly afterwards because it was a very personal moment. Mm-hmm. And for me, for her to have been put through, and it did calm the debate afterwards, in fairness to her, she managed to a certain degree, not totally calm, but it did calm the debate. But for me, there were some outstanding contributions in this debate. And the fact that certain people can hijack it, for me, is a huge difficulty.
Brian,
just on the Jim Walsh and the Breen O'Donnell point, what strikes me about that is, and I think it's fair to say, a lot of people were appalled by the tone and the content of those speeches. On the other hand, maybe it's better that they actually made the speeches they made so that people could actually see how they viewed it, how they wanted to represent their
position.
Isn't
that what democracy is all about?
Then you actually see it, rather than perhaps someone coming out and effectively dancing around it, but maybe not spelling out exactly how they see it, even though for a lot of people they would have found it very, very offensive. But then people can see that and judge it as it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually think on balance, my own view would be, maybe it's better that they made the speeches they made.
I'm more offended at the political process rather than the actual content, because in a debate like this, you are going to get extreme views and very, very different views. So it wasn't even that. Like, I mean, you kind of half expected it, from Jim Walsh. But it's just that there seemed to have been a cross-party understanding that this finally needs to be agreed. And through the committees and elsewhere, it seemed as if we were finally getting somewhere and we were going to, you know, move on this. For me, with the whole Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill, when it finally goes through, my question is, well, what have we got to show for it after 30 years and, you know, since the X case? The Irish Times commissioned a survey earlier this year which showed that more than 8 out of 10 people supported a legal termination of pregnancy in cases of rape or incest. Very high support. There was fetal abnormalities. I thought there was a way that... I actually think this is a missed opportunity because this legislation is legislated for 92.
The pro-life people will say to us that they have an issue with how... with what people were asked, just to make that clear, because I know that...
Indeed. But also just even on the whole, you know, the big issue has been suicide. Like, it always strikes me. I think what came out very strongly in the procedures was that, you know, this whole notion that suicide or termination of pregnancy is not a treatment for suicide. I think the public understand that in a strict medical sense, but in a country where we have more than 600 suicides a year, the reason why I think that the public have twice rejected the exclusion of suicide is that there's a much, much greater understanding of the relationship between mental health and physical health. So we will have this legislation through and everybody will be clapping themselves on the back for finally making this thing. And it's so out of step with a consensus that has emerged over the last 20 years. And I think, and my own prediction is, that we're going to have a fetal abnormality case in the courts very soon. And at that stage, we will not be able to complain about judge-made law. We will not be able to complain about interpretation by judges of
because
what they
say. Because it's a situation that has been created by the executive.
We were given a unique opportunity and we haven't done it. And look, I mean, this doesn't stop here, because there will be inevitable challenges. Will there be an Article 26 reference? They didn't do it for any of the financial bills. And I don't think that that's a good course. But, you know, this issue is going to be with us for a very, very long time. And when you look back and think, well, what was the whole tone of that debate when Ireland passed this legislation? And you just think of...
And I think particularly in the case of fetal abnormalities, there is no case constitutionally for us not to have done that. There is a case on the rape and incest, I can understand. But on the fetal abnormalities, we had a very good debate in the Shannon. My colleagues, Senators McAneill and O'Donnell, brought forward amendments and we had an excellent debate on that issue. But the reality is, they say has not been constitutionally tested. Is that not the case for most things that we've done?
I think the public has a very nuanced view, actually, in relation to abortion. You know, they see very difficult, tough situations that need to be legislated for. None of that was done in the case of fetal abnormality, inevitable miscarriage, for example. None of those cases were dealt with at all in this legislation. And at the same time, I think the public don't want to see a liberal abortion regime. But, you know, I'd agree with the point that Dermot made there about the lack of regard for process and all of this, where the government was going through the motions of having a dáil debate on this, with the distinct you know, intention not to allow any real democratic consideration of it at all. And the example that that exemplifies this perfectly to me is an amendment that Dennis Nocton had down to the legislation, which was providing for, in circumstances where a woman, her request for termination has been refused and she's to go before a panel of three medical experts, and to enable that woman to have an advocate with her, somebody else, her husband, a partner, her
why
mother,
would you not
whoever.
Legally
why would you not
that
allow
situation?
That? Yeah. Even James Riley, when he was speaking in the debate, he seemed to give the impression that he thought that was provided for. And Dennis Nocton had an amendment to correct that, to make sure that that would be allowed, to put in the word and stroke or, to put in those words in the legislation. I don't think there's anybody in the Dáil that would disagree with that. And yet the government voted that down. And that's an indication of the fact that they brought this legislation to the Dáil and they had no intention of allowing any democratic input into it whatsoever.
Okay.
And they went ahead then to punish Dennis Nocton for doing that.
All right,
and removed him from
the Health Committee. All right, we're going to leave that one there. We're going to take a quick break. Back with more after this. Welcome back to Saturday with Clare Byrne. In the studio today, we've Roisin Shortall, Independent TD and former Junior Minister for Health, Independent Senator Gillian Van Turnhout, Dervil MacDonald, Legal Editor with the Irish Independent, Brian Dowling from RTE's Political Staff and Mary Minahan from the Irish Times. It's our last show of the season and we're taking a look back, I suppose, at what happened over the political year. And because of everything that's happened towards the end of the political year, it's sort of hard to remember what happened quite a way back. But you probably will if I say primary care centres. Remember the saga around that. Roisin, of course, stepped down as Junior Minister for Health over the selection process used by Minister James Riley in that debacle. Let's remind ourselves of how he explained the complicated procedure involved in choosing where those centres should be located.
I have laid it out three or four times to you, the criteria. They're quite extensive criteria, and because all of them act in different ways, it's a bit like a multiplier. I mean, one and one makes two, and two make four. But four by four makes 16, and not four and four makes eight. And so it is with this. It's a logistical, if logarithmic progression. So there is nothing simple. There is nothing simple about it.
Certainly wasn't anything simple about it. But Roisin, you're outside the tent, and he's inside the tent. Any regrets at this stage?
No, no regrets at all. I did what I believed I had to do. I was in an impossible situation. You know, I think when you listen back to that speech, it certainly hasn't improved with time. And the explanation is still as clear as mud.
But he survived it. That's
oh, he did
thing,
survive
didn't,
it.
Isn't
well,
it?
Yes, you can say he survived it. Another way of putting it is that the government tolerated that kind of nonsense. That we heard in that speech, no explanation whatsoever. As far as I was concerned, this was undoubtedly a case of stroke politics. And yet, you know, we had the awful spectacle, in my view, of the Labour Party defending that kind of behaviour. I mean, I understood that one of the reasons why the Labour Party was in government, to ensure that resources are spent fairly. And, you know, if the Labour Party is not about spending resources fairly, allocating resources where they're most needed, then I don't know what it's about. But there is a big danger that, you know, when parties have been out of government for a long time, and there's a lot of resentment built up about, in this case, where Fianna Fáil had their snouts in the trough, if you like to put it crudely like that, and had, you know, control of the action for so long that, you know, ministers came in and wanted a share of the action. And in spite of all of the promises of open government and objective, you know, decision making, evidence based policy, all of that kind of talk, people still want to be able to pull a stroke in their constituency.
How cast?
And unfortunately, that has continued.
How cast out are you by the Labour Party? I mean, do you still have friendly connections within the movement? And I'm speaking, I suppose, about ministers, serving ministers at the moment. I mean, are you still in that sense?
Well, no. When I resigned over this, the primary care debacle and other problems within the Department of Health, I was ostracised, I suppose, by the senior ministers in Labour. And apart from Joan Burton, none of them really speak to me at all. And that happened straight away. Obviously, I would have friends among the rest of the, of the parliamentary party, and I would have contact with them from time to time.
So that ostracisation has still
continued on. Yeah, I mean, people don't like you to call something for what it is. And I suppose the very fact that some of the Labour ministers were very much implicated in that type of politics and, you know, looking after themselves and looking after their constituency in that manner, in a kind of cloak and dagger manner. And I suppose I lifted the lid on some of that and people didn't like it.
Mm. Who likes going to work, though, and not being spoken to by the people that you've associated with so closely over many years? Must be very difficult, is my point.
Well, it's different, certainly. There's no doubt about that. And I mean, I think it does raise issues. I now see very clearly how difficult it is for independent members of the Dáil. And that's a thing that I hadn't appreciated before. And things like, for example, you know, automatic speaking rights. Yeah. Independent members don't have those. There's no right to be a member of a committee. Mm. And I mean, this is an absolutely ludicrous situation in my view. You know, we're elected as legislators. A lot of the legislation is done in committees. And yet, if you're an independent member, you're denied a right to membership
of
a committee.
You could join the technical group.
Or speaking rights. And can I just make one other point in that regard? I mean, there is support funding provided for TDs. In the case of a party, the funding is provided to the party leader. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are now five Labour TDs outside of the parliamentary party. And there's about €200,000 a year that goes to the party leader still.
Paul Bradford made this point about
Fine
Gael last
and the same
night.
Applies to Fine Gael. And there's no defence for that. And I mean, I'm not saying that we should necessarily have it, but I don't believe that the party should continue to receive it.
And what about
it.
The technical group? Is that an option?
Well, the technical group, it's a very large group.
But you would have more in terms of speaking rights, wouldn't you, if you were part of the technical group?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that there's that much coherence to it. It is a technical group purely for the purposes of ensuring speaking rights, and that they can operate as a bloc within the Dáil. But I mean, there's a very wide range of politics and views within that group, and they've had their own difficulties over the past couple of years. And, you know, I don't think it'd be that easy
to work within that
group.
Yeah. Okay. And maybe it's just on
Gillian,
a strange anomaly in the rules that in the Shannon, when we first came into the Shannon as independent Taoiseach's nominees, which was unusual that the Taoiseach had nominated so many independents, we were first told that we would have to join with the university senators to be part of a group. But when we looked at the rules, there was nothing prohibiting us in the Shannon of having a second independent group. So we actually have two independent groups, one of the university senators and one of the Taoiseach's nominees. Because what Roisin is saying is right, unless you group together, you don't get speaking rights, you don't get onto committees. So we actually have to facilitate and work together.
I think there will be some revisiting of the standing orders now. And I think, there's a strong likelihood that there are grounds for taking a case against the standing orders the way they operate at the moment, because certain members, if they're independent or become independent, are being denied their full role as a legislator.
The fastest growing group in the Dáil.
And the rule in the Shannon was you had to have five.
I think it would be very interesting to see a legal challenge to the standing
orders. We started this section talking about Minister James Reilly. Mary, can I come to you on this? Just going back to that clip again and the explanation in the Dáil over the primary care centres. And again, the whole point, the substantive point is he's still in the job.
He is. He's the party's deputy leader. He's based in Dublin, which is hugely important for a party like Fine Gael. And he has weathered more storms than any other politician I can think of in recent years. Yes, the logistical logarithmic progression was farcical and ridiculous, and we sort of snigger about it now looking back, but Roisin probably won't like me saying this. I think he has redeemed himself a bit in recent times by his handling of the abortion legislation. He was quite patient and sure-footed throughout with Roisin's successor, Alex White on his shoulder. But look, he's got a lot of difficulties facing him in future. The College of GPs have withdrawn from, the HSE clinical programmes in protest over fees and so on. So there's a whole, it could be a winter of discontent in the health services. I know we're enjoying this beautiful summer now, but look, the government now seems to have this unshakable majority. It was Roisin's colleague, Tommy Bruin, who spoke about the Magnificent Seven who are outside the fold of the Labour Party. But look, in the past fortnight, Fine Gael has its own Magnificent Seven. You know, it's just lost five TDs and two senators in one fell swoop. Mm-hmm. So, these massive majorities aren't unshakable.
Brian, just on the James Reilly thing, is it all about loyalty? If you're loyal to End, are you immune?
Well, he certainly would have been one of the most loyal of Enda's people, and certainly in the leadership, he was there with him every day, every minute. I think the big issue for James Reilly, and not taken away from the issue that Roisin resigned on, but and it is a part of this issue, is the introduction of universal health insurance. Mm. Now, in the programme for government, we were to see essentially the bedrocks and the foundation of this laid down by 2016. I think there are already indications that the government is trying to ease the path to say this is going to take a second term.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at where we are at the halfway point, one would have expected we would have been much further down the road. Mm. Like, a key component of this would be free GP care.
Yeah, and actually,
and that was to be the easy part of this.
Fergal Bowers is reporting today that a spokesperson for the health minister said there is still a major commitment to primary care, and a memo will be brought to cabinet shortly on accelerating free GP care. But memos are memos. I mean, it's interesting
to
talk about
is, if
government.
Even take a point of accelerating free GP care.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to complete a transition from where we were in 2011 to universal health insurance in 2016, I think most people who are involved in this area would have expected that by this stage, the free GP care part of it would have been finished and done, and we'd be moving on to the next bit. I think that is so far behind. Yes, there have been papers published on it, but there's a white paper due, but that's still due. Mm.
But you think that's going to be...
The detail of it, the costings of it. And there's
that's
going to
be James Riley's problem.
I think that is the single biggest test of James Riley. There's a lot of issues in health, but the flagship in terms of what the health strategy would be for this government was to transform the health service from where it stood in 2011 to where they expect it to be in 2016.
But those steps are set out very clearly in the programme for government. And, you know, the first term of government was all about front-loading the primary care element of it. So you'd have increased investment in primary care, switch activity away from expensive hospital locations, and have strengthened primary care so that that can then deal with the 90% of healthcare that is
but
required.
But
and that hasn't happened. That's the difficulty. And it's not just the free GP care that was supposed to be fully implemented
that's the whole
in this
point,
term.
I mean, in terms of any evaluation
that,
of...
It's investing in it, and they've lost... They've missed out on all of those timescales.
There's also a big issue with the non-consultant hospital doctors. There's a real crisis in the health service also in this issue. Like we see with staffing in hospitals, which the HSE have come before the Health and Children Committee saying that it is not a problem. And yet members like Senator Colin Burke have clearly shown us around the country, and Deputy Lee O'Caillon clearly shown around the country where this is going to be a
crisis
in the autumn.
All right. But look, getting rid of the Shannon is obviously far
and they
more
need
important.
To be addressed.
Roisin, I'm
just
going to move on because I want to talk about another minister who courted controversy, Alan Shatter. Here he is on Primetime in that debate with Mick Wallace, followed by his explanation about the whole matter to the Dáil.
Now, I would accept there's some individual decisions made, in my view, that defy logic and common sense
and should
not have been made. But there are others where people were unwell, where there were family bereavements, where it was quite right the Gardaí exercised his discretion. As Deputy Wallace knows, even without issuing tickets, the Gardaí exercised discretion. Deputy Wallace himself was stopped on a mobile phone last May by members of An Garda Síochána, and he was advised by the guard who stopped him that a fixed ticket charge could issue and he could be given penalty points. But the guard apparently, as I'm advised,
used his discretion,
and warned him and told him not to do it again.
First of all, that's news to me. Secondly, with regard to discretion, it's all very well to say they're using discretions here and there. The rule is, once it goes on the system, they should go to court to deal with it. Now, listen, there's...
By the way, are you not concerned that the minister should know about your private business dealing with the Gardaí?
I'm not remotely worried about what the minister knows.
With hindsight, do I think it was a mistake to mention the incident regarding Deputy Wallace? I explain my reasoning, but put simply, of course I do. Is it something for which I owe Deputy Wallace an apology? It is, and I've already apologised. Would I do it again? No, I wouldn't.
Dervil, got to come to you on this as legal editor of The Independent. Alan Shatter has had a mixed year. Any collateral damage, do you think, from that incident?
I think that he thinks he hasn't been wounded by it, but I think if he thinks honestly about it, he will concede that he has. I think had that been any other citizen, politician or individual other than Mick Wallace, that would have provoked a very, very, very serious crisis. Mm-hmm. And I think because of the personalities involved, everyone glossed over it. But I think it was kind of rare for Alan Shatter to kind of let the mask slip, as it were. He's very kind of smooth in the way that he goes about things. He's a prolific worker, absolutely prolific. And if you look at the
programme... I mean, I accept what you're saying about being a prolific worker, but he tends to get people's backs up quite a lot.
He does. And look, I mean, he kind of universally upsets an awful lot of people. And I wonder, kind of writing in this area a lot, will we look back on him as this kind of, you know, poacher turned gamekeeper, or someone who kind of really brought in this reform? Look, even if you look at the manner in which the Legal Services Bill, you know, is going through, it's absolutely disgraceful. Actually, it's meant to be, you know, for the biggest reform to the legal profession. We had an hour in the committee stage the other day, and he is very, very good in terms of putting through reform, but he provokes and angers a lot of people. And I just thought that the Wallace incident was... It was kind of, literally, had it been any other individual other than Mick Wallace, I think there would be serious, serious questions, and I think people would have been calling for his resignation.
But because Mick Wallace was discredited over his tax affairs,
yeah, he discredited
there wasn't
himself,
the hue and cry.
You know, so there wasn't a hue and cry. But I kind of thought, well, okay, we'll put that at the time. I remember thinking, and Pat Kenny, you know, there's a reason why he's so superb at Current Affairs Broadcasting. He spotted it when others kind of might have taken a little bit of while for it to sink. You know, he zoned in on it straight away. But I just kind of think, if you take Mick Wallace's name out and put any other name in, you know, he had access to private information about a citizen, even if that citizen was an elected member of the Dáil. And I thought that was a very, very serious slip of the mask. And I think that he has been wounded by it. I think what has costed him is the same thing as kind of the Riley effect. He was, you know, he's one of the most loyal people there. But I think that he was definitely shaken by that. And I think that he has adjusted his tone somewhat in recent months as a result of that. But it'll be very interesting to see. I always find this time of the electoral cycle very, very interesting, because in the first two and a half years that the government is in control, I always kind of feel that the permanent civil servants kind of shift when it comes into the second half of the cycle. And he has a very, very ambitious programme for reform, and I wonder, will he be able to get everything through? Like, I find, just as a working correspondent in this area, it can be very, very difficult to track him. Like, you only find out about speeches when it's emailed to you. You know, he's kind of constantly ahead of himself, you know, sometimes. But I think that regardless of how he kind of came out, and the apology, it was a bit like kind of Norris. It wasn't really an apology,
you know,
and this kind of rhetorical, should I apologise? Yes, I should. But, you know, and it wasn't kind of heartfelt. If that had been me,
sorry if I
and
offended
someone
you.
Knew,
sorry,
yeah,
if you took offence.
Yeah, sorry if you took offence. But, you know, if that had been me and a serving government minister was able to access personal details about my life through the Garda Commissioner, and then to kind of, you know, to kind of throw it off as if to blame the Garda Commissioner for bringing forward this information, I thought it was a disgraceful incident.
Gillian.
Yeah, I suppose watching primetime that night, you know, the difficulty I thought was that Alan Shatter was actually winning the debate, and then he vies into this personal information, and he just, it was ill-judged. It was reprehensible, and it should not have happened. On the other side, as a parliamentarian, I have to say Alan Shatter is one of the best ministers when we come into the House, because he will argue and discuss legislation. He will discuss amendments you have before legislation. He really will tease out, as ministers should, because other ministers will come in and they'll ram it through. But he will try and engage and have that debate. So it's, you know, for me, it's a very difficulty, because I have to say, as a parliamentarian, one, I know that if Alan Shatter is coming into the House and I want to put forward a point, I will have all my homework done, because he will pick me up if there's something that I get wrong. You know, so it's you really prep well. And it means that you have really good discussions. Some of the reforms he's bringing in, for me, will make a huge difference. We've just done on the courts bill, in the children's courts. Mm. We're taking really significant steps to reform. So there are things happening, but that moment was not, would not be a highlight.
Not his best.
I think one of the things that might set him aside, perhaps, notwithstanding the fact, and I think it's widely acknowledged, he has a capacity to get up people's backs, I think, across the political spectrum. But one of the things that might set him aside in terms of being a minister and dealing with legislation is that he probably has the best track record of any politician as someone who brought forward legislation himself for many years.
Oh, in opposition, he was the most active.
He has a real understanding of the process, and also the difficulties that face people sitting on the other side trying to get amendments or trying to get legislation. I suspect that's one of the reasons why people within the Dáil and people in opposition find that he's actually better to deal with on that front, because he has a certain natural empathy with it, notwithstanding his other, if you like, his the political streak in him that's very, very strident.
I'm just going to leave that one there, and we want to come to one more story before we finish. But Mary, before we do that, Fianna Fáil's year, can you just give us a quick look at what happened, how Micheál Martin fared? Quite well, actually. And then some people say
that when it came to the legislation we've just spoken about, the abortion legislation, allowing a free vote was not his finest moment.
Yeah, I'm sure Fianna Fáil would argue, you know, there's more to the year than what happened at the very end with the abortion legislation, but inevitably that's what we're going to focus on. And I think what's happened in Fianna Fáil has been masked by the convulsions going on in Fine Gael, but the free vote that Micheál Martin offered was, you know, really making a virtue out of necessity. But who could have predicted that 14 of his 19 TDs would vote against what he and his health spokesman were proposing? And also,
but do you look at that as a sign of weakness? I mean, does it just depend on your view on that, that perhaps we're looking at a new progressive Fianna Fáil, the one that we were promised, or has the leadership, has Micheál Martin lost the respect of his TDs?
I know certainly the Fianna Fáil spin doctors would say I'm being very old fashioned in my approach, but I, you know, he has lost control of his people in the Shannon. You've got a sort of a weird situation where his own party senators are clashing with each other, and you know, I don't dispute the, you know, I don't dispute that they really believe what they're saying in most cases, but I think you'd have to be a bit naive to think that at least some of them weren't motivated by thinking, you know, maybe this is an opportunity for us to look like the only real anti-abortion candidates at the next general election. You know, I definitely think that was an
issue. So what's your outlook then for Fianna Fáil and Micheál Martin?
Well, it's back to the drawing board really for Micheál on this issue, I think, because he did promise to be constructive on it. And then when he was forced into a situation, and I understand why he couldn't do anything else, but when he was forced into a situation where he had to offer a free vote, that wasn't really constructive because it put a lot of pressure on Fine Gael people who were, you know, really had strongly held personal beliefs about abortion that they, you know, they couldn't kind of fall under the whip as they might have done so before.
So given that we're sort of midterm now, are you saying or would you agree that there might be a leadership challenge before the next general election? Is that in the mix?
Well, I think it was really significant that Michael McGrath came out against this legislation. Again, I don't doubt for a second his sincerity on that. But Micheál Martin was, I think, very careful not to appoint a deputy leader after the disastrous situation with Éamon O'Caoimh. And in a way, Michael McGrath, I think, became kind of the de facto deputy leader. You know, he's an excellent finance spokesman, very accessible, very understandable, really very constructive in debate and so on. And, you know, I think that has really, he's
next in line to the
throne. Opened up. He would certainly like to think so, I think.
Brian, what do you think?
I think let's see the local and the European elections next year, which will be the first real test. The party is polling in the mid-20s, so it's a considerable distance ahead of where it was in the general election. And it is, I think it's fair to say, it is certainly consolidating some of that support. But how strong that actually will be and how much of that can translate into actual votes, I think is a big issue. The party had dreadful local elections in 2004 and 2009. Essentially, a lot of their national infrastructure was decimated. They need to bring forward a whole layer of new candidates in those elections for the following general election. And I certainly, from talking to some people in Fianna Fáil, I think some of them would be fearful that some of the support they're getting is soft, that it's not that solid. But they're certainly, I think they certainly will be ahead of where they were in the general election. But I'm not quite too sure whether they will be polling in the mid-20s in a real election. Maybe they will. But I think that will be the big test. The big test for Micheál Martin will be, what can he deliver as leader over the course of those two elections? If they have a very good day, I think his position will be fine. If it's not what people expect, or not as good as people think could have been achieved, that may be a different
issue. Okay, so there'll be no move against him, in other words, until those two elections are out of the way.
I think of all the parties, Fianna Fáil did worse out of the Protection of Life during Pregnancy Bill. Obviously, Labour's position was very clear. It was kind of one of their flagship issues, so it didn't damage them. Fine Gael, when you think that, you know, at the worst, people were planning for up to 30 departures. So whatever the consequences of the rump that's been kind of left outside of the party, they managed to control it. It wasn't as bad as people thought. Fianna Fáil, it's been disastrous for them, and they had been doing quite well in terms of clawing back, looking at the opinion polls, you know, and, you know, I think most people were saying, oh my God, they could be in power, you know, by 2016. But this has really, it's just shown them to be, they're just all over the shop.
Roisin, I think you have a different view,
you know,
have you?
I think successive opinion polls would show that the abortion issue isn't a major determining factor when it comes to party loyalty or voting intentions. I would suspect that at this point, Fianna Fáil are pretty happy with their standing in the polls. You know, I think it's very easy to, you know, criticise what has happened within Fianna Fáil on this, but you have to bear in mind that abortion is one of those, probably the most
intractable issue.
Sensitive issue in terms of conscience. And we don't need a three-line whip on every issue that we vote on in the Dáil. I mean, that's old-style politics, really. You know, it doesn't happen in any other parliament. There was mixed views within Fianna Fáil. And, right, Micheál Martin couldn't carry his party with him on that issue. But so what? I mean, that was the position.
That whole notion
of... Can I just say, I think, you know, I don't think anybody is going to win or lose to any huge extent on this issue. I think there will be some damage done to Fine Gael, but I think that would be principally on the broken promise
But
issue.
If you leave aside, Roisin, the ballot box for a while, if you're in Fianna Fáil and you have, you're a member of the parliamentary party and you have leadership ambitions, are you sniffing the prey here now, the wounded prey?
That goes on all the time in politics. But I mean, you know, Micheál Martin's problem, in my view, is not the fact that his party was divided on the abortion issue. It's that he, you know, carries a huge amount of baggage in terms of being centrally involved as a senior cabinet minister during the whole collapse of the economy and, you know, what led up to that. And his difficulty is going to be, you know, trying to get away from that baggage that he has. And I think he's going to find it very difficult to do that.
I think it's also that the fact for me is that he was quite silent this week, that it took for Senator O'Brien to disassociate himself from his Senate colleagues, and we almost felt we were having a Fianna Fáil Ardèche at one stage in the Shannon. But we had some really good contributions, like from Senator Ned O'Sullivan and Senator Thomas Byrne on either side of the debate, who were excellent. But for me, there is an issue of leadership when, where are you? In this time where your party are fractious in public. You know, we don't wash our dirty linen in public, and you really could feel the tensions.
Well, in defence of Micheál Martin, O'Brien did say that, I went to him and asked him, and he came out pretty clearly and said that it was a source of regret to him. But you know, I think there's been a bit of a touch of the Teflon to Micheál Martin. Like, I think the polls show he has really escaped a lot, like, given that he was so centrally involved in the last cabinet.
Our time is up, not just for today, but for this season. The programme is back in September. Thank you to a great team who have stuck with it every single Saturday since September of last year. We're going to enjoy the summer. I hope you do too. And thank you very much for listening. Do take care.
And Saturday with Claire Byrne was produced by Peter Woods. The broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Research is by Leslie Anderson, and audio supervision this week was by Sheila Neve-Weal.